have this session. In July, EPA held its annual NARPM conference, that's the National Association of Remedial Project Managers, meeting in Portland, Oregon, and one of our most attended sessions was on green remediation. Because of its success, members of EPA's technical support project, led by the Engineering Forum, have taken this full-day session and are bringing back a number of the same talks as online seminars this fall and winter. So this is the first of three of those online seminars. EPA's definition of green remediation includes the practice of considering the environmental effects of a remediation strategy, that is, the remedy selected and the implementation approach, early in the process, and incorporating options to maximize the net environmental benefit of the cleanup action. Some practices are quite mature, such as construction, site best management practices, including stormwater runoff management and construction and demolition, debris recycling. Others are still emerging, including the use of renewable energy sources, such as wind and solar, to power remedial systems. Over the next three sessions, the online training will introduce you to the key technical, policy, and application aspects of green remediation. Before I turn it over to our first of two speakers, I remind you that you should put your phone on mute, and if you don't have a mute button, that's star six now, and again, do not put us on hold. Today's first speaker is Kathy Allen, Bosworth Center for Program Analysis. She co-chairs the EPA Climate Change and Contaminated Lands Working Group that is advancing green remediation, renewable energy development, and carbon sequestration. Prior to working in OSWR, Kathy managed EPA's Office of International Affairs, International Environmental Health Program, and supported agency preparations for the UN Commission on Sustainable Development and the World Summit on Sustainable Development. She enjoyed a two-year stint as a Mansfield Fellow living in Japan and assigned to Government of Japan offices addressing climate change. She has a BS in Mechanical Engineering and a BA in Political Science from Stanford University and an MS in Environmental Engineering from Johns Hopkins University. Welcome, Kathy.
Thank you very much for that introduction, and thank you, everybody, for attending the seminar on Thanksgiving week. I wish I could see you all. The NARPM meeting I found to be a very interesting session, and I was really glad that this clue-in session was set up so that we could share the discussions with more people. And if you go to slide two, what I'm really going to do is just set the stage for some of the future discussions. And in NARPM, I talked about several things, and one of them, just in general, the context and the drivers for going green and how it's impacting us. And then a little bit of discussion on sustainable development and how that impacts sustainable remediation or greener remediation. And then I wanted to just touch upon some of the things that EPA's Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response is focusing on, a little bit on our materials management, waste management activities, because I think that some of their tools we are going to be employing in green remediation. And then also then looking, highlighting some of our land management activities that we're focused on. And then finally, I'm going to provide one green remediation framework that has been produced by folks in OSWR, and I think that a lot of other interesting frameworks are being developed as well. So if you go to slide three, I'll talk a little bit about the drivers for going green. And of course, green has definitely gone mainstream, and you can see here are just some of the articles of people talking about it. And at NARPM, when I was allowed to have interactive slides, you know, there was one button that came up that talked about action and the other one that talked about hype. And I think that what we have within the green remediation area is folks who are taking green concepts and really focusing them into actionable items. It's really quite an exciting time. The second, go to slide four. I think we also know that there's a great deal of shifting public sentiment. And so if you look at some of the Gallup polling data, you see that there is a high percentage, 62 to 77%, that are focusing on environmental issues. And there's some other poll data I've got in here as well. But I think one of the interesting things to consider as well is that even within our government discussions that are going on right now, talking about economic stimulus and things like that, there's a great deal of focus on green jobs and going green. And so I think that you're just going to see more drivers and more understanding of how of the interconnectedness of what everybody's doing. On slide number 5, this slide, the part purpose of this slide is looking at energy prices. And of course, in July, when I gave this talk, the energy price was at $135 a barrel, which was significantly above what people were projecting for the highest price possible. Of course, now you have an energy price that is going down below the lower reference point. But I think that within green remediation and elsewhere, folks who have budgets to remediate, I think that the high energy prices in the past and the possibility that that will happen again is a very practical reason why people are looking at some of the energy issues related to cleanup. On slide 6, I just have a general slide, the driver of climate change. And I actually call that a driver in training, not to focus on it's been talked about for decades, but I think that if you go to slide 7, you'll see that across different sectors, there are real programs that are being implemented and even more national-level programs that are being discussed. I think that's going to have an impact on all of us who are implementing environmental programs. So you can look that there actually are regional initiatives where they have a cap-and-trade program in place. You have states with renewable portfolio standards who have incentives in place to develop renewable energy. And again, I think that this slide is already a little bit outdated, and I think over the next several months we'll be hearing a lot more about this. If you go to slide 8, just a few more drivers. I think in the remediation world there's a great deal of advancement that people are in innovations and advancement in both engineering and manufacturing. I think that there's a big openness in public policy to understand the interconnectedness of both different impacts on environmental media, but also the interconnectedness of with the economy and with the local communities. And, of course, the global and economic and development changes, I'll talk a little bit more in a minute. But I think, at least for NARP, I mean, here, I think the key drivers are folks like us sitting around these phones today and talking about how do we make, you know, incremental improvements in what we're doing right now so that we get the biggest bang for our buck when we take our remediation actions. If you go to slide 9, I'm going to move from some of the drivers for this focus on green and talk a little bit about sustainable development. So people use different, have their favorite terms for green remediation. I always like the term greener remediation because I think remediation has always been focused on green elements. A lot of people are talking about sustainable remediation. So I just wanted to talk about the sustainable development, the term. Of course, the term is really founded in balancing social, economic, and environmental issues. And actually, I think it really stems from an initial focus internationally to stamp out poverty and the need for economic growth, but the impact that some of this growth was having on local and global environments, and also whether or not the economic growth was focused on meeting enough social goals. So I think that as people who are working on green remediation and sustainable remediation go and talk to more audiences focused on sustainable development, it's just important for us to remember what we all know already, that it's this very broad concept. On slide 10, I just shared the Brundtland Report's definition. I think Gro Brundtland's definition is one that is commonly used, that sustainable development is development that meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. You can then go to slide 11. And I just wanted to highlight something that came out of the Commission on Sustainable Development in Chapter 20 of Agenda 21, which probably most people don't follow. It's a document that's been around for a long time, and some countries and some localities really focus on implementing this. And it's something that came out of the Rio Conference in 1992. But I just think it's important to highlight that within the sustainable development community, the prevention of the generation of hazardous waste and the rehabilitation of contaminated sites are key elements to the sustainable development agenda. So, again, I think that goes back to something that we all, of course, know, but cleaning up sites is, within the sustainable development community, absolutely a priority. And I think that that will come up more because I think that part of green remediation is trying to sort out how to balance different goals and objectives. And then finally on slide 12, I think that depending on who you talk to and which group you go to, there are lots of different ways to frame agreeing. Some countries and some corporations and others really focus on sustainability. EPA focused a lot on the terms stewardship and pollution prevention and materials management. So I think that they all have the same philosophy and approach they're promoting. So if you go to slide 13, I'm just going to talk a little bit about OSWR, Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response, where I work. And we have more than three, but we kind of usually highlight three areas of work. And one is materials management, which has often been looked at as waste management, but in fact, the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act is really focused on conserving resources and recovering resources so they don't become waste. Land management through our cleanup and revitalization programs, and then emergency preparedness and response. And I will not be talking much about emergency preparedness and response today, although, of course, removal programs and other sorts of activities are also have been and continue to look at green remediation options. So I just wanted to touch a little bit on materials management because I think it has an impact on what we're talking about in green remediation. And if you go to slide number 14, this actually comes from the World Resources Institute, and it's the most basic material cycle flow that I could find. And it talks about you're using materials and you produce goods and services, and then when you're done with them, you have waste and pollution and these kinds of things. And of course, this is a characterization and does not show any of the nuances. But that's been a typical view of material cycle. And if you go to slide 15, I think, you know, an older view of the cradle to grave cycle was you would extract materials and manufacture products and use those products and dispose of them. And of course, we've left that model a long time ago, but I think it's important to have it as a comparison to slide 16, which is the life cycle concept that most people are talking about now, which is cradle to cradle, which by design, from the whether if you're doing chemistry and making pharmaceuticals and other things, your molecule builders and others are looking by design on how to maximize your material usage and minimize waste and environmental harm. And you have this closed loop life cycle way of looking at things. So if you go to slide 17, I think that this will tie in some to what Jeff's going to talk about next time, which is life cycle concepts and remediation. And I think that, in general, you apply a life cycle analysis to a product that you're making. So a couple decades ago, you might be making a can, and you might be analyzing what's happening in your own facility, which is still a very important thing to do. But a life cycle of that can would look at it from materials extraction to production to use to disposal or hopefully reuse or recycling. And at a recent meeting, of an industrial meeting of the Sustainable Remediation Forum, I heard a speaker from England who was talking about how their policy is to look at the life cycle analysis of the property. And I find that a really intriguing model because I think that the life cycle for our properties, you could look at the life cycle of the property. But I think that life cycle tools in this practice, life cycle analysis practice, has grown a great deal over the last decade, can be applied to remedial decision making and can provide remedial project managers with some really useful information and the ability to compare different approaches. But I think it's important to understand that a life cycle analysis, you really have to determine how you're going to frame that analysis. And I also think that within life cycle analysis, comparing one action with the other for the same pollutant, so whether it's a chemical of concern in the soil and groundwater or whether it's carbon, is very different than trying to compare those pollutants against each other. And, of course, for those of you working on this, that's where some of the challenge comes in and where we have to think carefully about what's the correct way to look at this different information that you get when you apply life cycle tools to a remediation site. I don't think everybody does look at, by the way, at the life cycle analysis of the property. I just thought that was a very intriguing way to adopt the principle. So moving on from the discussion of materials management and life cycle analysis, I just wanted to talk a little bit about some of the things we've been looking at EPA and our cleanup and remediation programs on slide 18. And some of the things that we've been looking at that are part of greener remediation look at sustainable site reuse, cleaner energy on sites, or less energy use on sites, land restoration to increase carbon sinks, which is something that we're still at the earlier stage of research on, and then also this practice of greener remediation. So if you go to slide 19, this is actually a draft slide, looking at sustainable site reuse and potential impact on climate change. And I think this pie chart is a little bit older version. But what I wanted you to look at is some of the information at the top of the pie chart. So we have greenhouse gas emissions in this country of about 7,000 million metric tons of CO2 equivalent a year. And if you look at the outer ring, the natural land sink in the United States offsets some of those emissions. So some people look at things like, well, the more land sink you have, then you can offset some of your emissions. And I think that as we talk about reusing land and protecting green space, that can become an important thing to analyze, although we're sort of at the earlier stages of analyzing that. I also think one thing we're looking at is sort of the local passenger transportation. About, I think it's about 11% of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions in 2005 came from local passenger transportation, which really gets into how we develop our land and how we develop our cities. And again, I think that although remediating one particular site does not address all local planning issues, I think that those of you who have been working with brownfields and the other programs realize that part of what they're talking about is thinking about some of these things and the growth and redevelopment patterns. So if you go to slide number 20, we've looked at a number of different things, and one of them is an average of 2.2 million acres of green space are developed each year in the U.S. And so we're still doing calculations, but we know that this has a result, an impact on carbon in the soil and in vegetation. So we're in the process of completing an analysis to see if we can get a better handle on what that means, and our Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization also has a grant out where people are starting to try to understand more the differences in terms of greenhouse gases between green space development and land cleanup and reuse. I think also if you look at sustainable site reuse, new infrastructure is constructed to provide services to develop green space, but if you reuse sites, you can impact not just the climate change impact, but all sorts of environmental impacts by being able to reuse infrastructure. And then I think just at the end, I think that there's a projection that vehicle miles traveled are expected to increase by about 50% over the next 20 years. And also in 2030, about half of the buildings that we're going to be using will have been built after 2000. So I think there are some opportunities for those people who are thinking about these kinds of issues to have some pretty direct impact on climate change. And also, I talk a lot about climate change because that's what I'm working on now, but I think also all the other environmental impacts that green remediation addresses. If you go to slide 21, these are just a couple of graphics that lay out visually the business as usual land practices where you have more of a focus on pushing the community footprint outward and not having a big focus on redeveloping lands and the impacts on vehicle miles traveled. And then if you go to number 22, it just shows some of the lower carbon approaches where you're looking more at infill and you're trying to explicitly reduce vehicle miles traveled. So this is one area for folks who are working on land revitalization to focus on. On slide number 23, something else that Oswer and some of our partners have been focused on a great deal, the second area I wanted to talk about, had to do with clean energy development on contaminated sites. And, of course, related to what I just said, a lot of our sites have proper zoning and existing infrastructure and access to transmission lines, many times transmission lines that do have capacity to take more energy. And siting clean energy on these sites can be a viable reuse. It provides an economic value for the property, and a lot of our properties are in areas where there's not an obvious economic value, and it maximizes the land use. And I think it's also really important as the country really starts to focus on renewable energy development that these things have to be put someplace, and it will have an impact on land use. And I think that a lot of the sites that we manage could really provide a viable option for some of this renewable energy development. And if you go to slide number, and you can see we have a website at the bottom of this page that I encourage you to take a look at on slide 23. But on slide 24, I just included one map as an example that's looking at utility scale photovoltaic for solar energy generation. But we've done maps for biomass and wind, and we're also revising these maps because there are a lot of people looking at solar in the East Coast, and they're not coming up with our current screening criteria. But essentially what we did is we worked with the Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Laboratory, and they have a mapping of different renewable energy potentials, and we weighed this against things like access to transmission lines, the size of the property, graded roads, and we started to analyze, do some of the sites that EPA tracks across our different programs have viable options for both utility scale and also smaller scale renewable energy generation. And actually on the website on the earlier slide, we've now upgraded this mapping into a Google Earth map, which is a little more interactive. So I encourage you all to take a look at that. And then on slide number 25, the page number doesn't show up on it, but we also developed incentive fact sheets for each state. And on one side, we laid out the current clean energy incentives, and on the other side, the current incentives for development of contaminated land. And so on this website, whatever state you're in, you can get a fact sheet about the incentives for both ways to develop the land or the clean energy, and there are contacts that people can follow up. So for us, if you go to page 26, and again, I think some of these projections from the Energy Information Agency have probably changed with some of the different focus in the country right now, but we just did a kind of back-of-the-envelope calculation of how much energy the Energy Information Agency was expecting the U.S. to generate in 2010. And then, but based on our rough screening of land available to develop different energy, you can see that both for solar and both and for wind, if you were to use the land that was available, it's more than enough land to meet what's projected. Now, I do just want to say, we know that this is just a screening tool, and a lot of properties that screen high won't be appropriate for renewable energy use, but a lot that screen low and some that screen low we already know are being found appropriate for renewable energy use. But this is just a sort of layout that it is enough of a potential that it could really help the U.S. Meet some of its renewable energy goals and some of the states who currently have very clear projections and short time frames to meet these renewable portfolio standards. So then going to page 27, something else that we're starting to look at is looking at soil amendments and ecological restoration as carbon sinks as part of our greener remediation and climate change activities. And we did a look at the properties that just EPA tracks, so RCRA sites, Superfund sites, brownfield grantees, federal facilities. And about 13.6 million of the acres that we track are actually in non-urban areas. And we have we're looking at approximately about 3.2 million acres of abandoned mine land. And a lot of these lands really don't have any sort of soil function at all, or much soil or much carbon, and nothing is growing there. And we also started to look at what happens when you reforest mine lands. And one of the things that we're looking at right now is we have a remediation process where we apply different sorts of soil amendments, you know, all sorts of organic soil amendments. We're trying to understand what that means in terms of permanent carbon capture. But I think that regardless of the carbon impact, which we are analyzing right now, this remediation project is a very excellent green remediation example because it is very successful at capturing the metals that are causing water quality damage and allowing a healthy ecosystem to grow up there in some lands that were just really so damaged that they were no longer being used for much of anything. So that is the third thing that we're looking at and have some different research and analysis going on. And then finally on page 29, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the broader concept of green and greener remediation, which the three things I just listed before are relate to and are part of. So of course, all of you know this already, but there's a commitment to more optimal solutions. We are having to deal with the cost of fuel and electricity. People are understanding that although remediation is inherently a sustainable activity to clean up problems from the past and the present, that our remediation activities have a footprint. And so folks like Region 9 and Region 10 have started programs called like the Clean Up Clean Air program, where they're specifically trying to understand what sort of local air impacts do we have when we do our remediation process. And our Region 9 and Region 10 are on the West Coast. And then we have some folks in our Colorado office and elsewhere who have been looking explicitly at the water-land impact of the cleanups and trying to minimize the negative aspects of that footprint. I think also that a lot of you on this line have a lot of expertise on how to optimize current remediation so that it has less of an impact and more of a positive impact. And I think that you'll hear from Deb and others that people are also trying to understand how this fits into our option selection criteria. And of course, a lot of aspects of sustainability, you could say, are captured in different ways, looking at communities and costs and complying with other environmental requirements. But I think most people agree that we could be doing more and much more systematically to lead and get these broader benefits. So if you go to page 30, I just wanted to share one way of looking at green remediation that some folks at EPA have put together, and that is to look across from deconstruction and demolition and removal to the cleanup, remediation, and waste part slice, to the design and construction for reuse, to the sustainable long-term stewardship. And if you go to page 31, I'm not going to go through this right now, but this just gives some of the examples that you can consider as you're going looking at these greener approaches. And then on to 32, I think it's also an interesting way to lay out the entire sustainable development three-tiered stool again to look at the sustainable development, how green remediation could fit into the sustainable development framework. So I'd just like to conclude with this last slide on slide number 33, which is this document called Guidelines for Making Environmentally Sound Decisions in the Superfund Remedial Process. And I wanted to point out that some very innovative folks in US EPA Chicago office published this in 1993. And their goal was to introduce the concept of pollution prevention, which was one of the framing terms that we used in the agency in the early 90s to talk about sustainable development, so that the Superfund and RCRA cleanup programs would start to get this philosophy. And I just found it interesting that in the introduction, they talked about how they were focused on decreasing waste at their cleanup sites, but that they could envision a future where cleanups would also deal with restoring wetlands or offsetting carbon and dealing with global climate change. And I just think it's interesting because I think it just highlights that a lot of people who have been doing remediation for a long time have been thinking about this for a long time. And I just think that we now have an opportunity to capture some of this experience and enthusiasm and in a more formal way begin to understand how it impacts our programs. So slide 34, this is the end of my presentation, and I'm happy to take any kinds of questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. We do have some time for questions now. We're going to alternate between the online questions from the streaming audio folks and the phone people. Let's start with one from the streaming audio folks. The question is from Carl Dupol from Green Building Solutions and Supplies in Edgemont, Pennsylvania. What connections are being made with the U.S. Green Building Council LEED on green remediation? Kathy?
You know, I was more involved with some of those early connections way back than I am now, but I know that I can't give you specifics about the latest things that have happened, but I know that many connections have been made. So, for example, some of our regional offices are specifically working with
Do a different thing.
Please put your phone on mute if you're not speaking.
So I think that in our brownfields program and in our regional programs, and also in our Superfund redevelopment initiative and our RCRA brownfields initiative, all of those initiatives have made are reaching out to the green building community, both on specific developments. So in our Denver office, I'm most familiar with some of the work they've done in the Denver office and the California office, to actually, when these sites are cleaned up and redeveloped, they're working with builders who are building greener buildings. And they actually see it as an opportunity to build in a better way. And I think also through the Brownfields program and the Smart Growth programs and other programs, there are being some explicit connections made. And on the other side, I think that we have been encouraging within the green building world to be very explicit about thinking about where you're siting your new buildings, because it's not just what you put into the building or how the building functions, but it is, of course, where the building is located. And I believe in the LEED certification, you get credit for siting on a brownfield. So if you need more direct linkages, you can send me an email, and I can get some of the contacts who work on these things more regularly than I do.
Thank you, Kathy. Let's take a question from the phone. Someone on the phone, if you had your phone on mute through the system, to get off mute, it's #6. So any questions from the phone?
Hi, this is Heather Nifong from Illinois EPA. Kathy, you had referenced a draft protocol for sampling and analysis to account for the carbon assets associated with the soil amendments. Is that something that's available online?
I don't know if that's online yet, because that's focused specifically on the how do you take the sample and how do you analyze it. But I think it's something that we're using on pilot sites, and it's something that I believe I could send to you. I don't know if it's up online. It might be on the Ecological Revitalization website on CLUIN.
Okay, I can look there.
Okay. If not, email me and I can get it to you.
Thank you. We don't have any other questions on the streaming audio side right now. So anybody else from on the phone? Go ahead.
Yes, this is Tom Feely from BioGreen, and I'd like to direct my question to Catherine. Catherine, we are making we're a small company that is actually making a product that is used in soil rejuvenation, and we've been very successful with the USDA and doing some tests with them. And could you direct us to some other areas where this would be applicable?
You mean like other geographic areas or other sorts of cleanup sites, or?
Yes, more or less agencies that would be, and how would we approach these agencies?
I do think we have groups that work on technology development here. And so if you could send me an email, I could get you in contact with the technology development groups.
Okay.
And I think that they could provide you with better steps.
Okay.
More concrete steps.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Here's one more from the internet. Does the EPA have any active efforts to formally roll sustainability considerations into the FS process, the feasibility study process? For example, some consider the impacts under the short-term effectiveness criteria and are rolling the evaluation into the existing process. Others are building their own criteria. Is EPA going to officially advocate a process? This is a question from Tom Pelea of CH2M Hill in Evergreen, Colorado. Kathy?
We do not have a formal policy statement on that right now, but we do have a group within the Superfund program that just formed within the last month or two that is starting to look at policy questions within Superfund program and how policy should or should not address the concepts of green or sustainability. So there is not a decision on specific things, whether or not to do anything or specific things to be done right now. But there are people who are explicitly looking at those questions.
Okay, thanks. Anybody else from the phone have a question? We'll take one or two more, and then we'll move on to the next presentation.
Dorothy Allen from Massachusetts. Hello?
Hello.
Hello. I have a question regarding risks. A lot of our program is risk-based, and there's certainly risks associated with climate change, and they're quantified in the IPCC report, in the Stern report, in the World Health Organization reports. Is EPA looking at risks from climate change and how those can be balanced against the risks that we are using in Superfund to do cleanups and cleanup decisions?
That's a good question. This is not really an agency policy position, I'm saying, but just things to think about. So the agency and others are looking very closely at climate change risk. And I think within the green remediation community, people are starting to try to grapple with, well, we've got our cleanup risk, the risk-based program, and climate change risk. But I think that if you look at how the climate change folks are looking at, first, climate change risk, which is one area of study and analysis, but also climate change mitigation, what they typically do with climate change mitigation is try to find where are the biggest areas where we could actually reduce greenhouse gas emissions and how long would it take and how much would it cost. So I think that there has been some work done to try to get a footprint, for example, of the Superfund program in terms of energy and carbon. But in general, all the things that I have seen have not shown that, you know, remediation programs are way up there in terms of the amount of carbon relative to all the carbon coming out of utility plants and all sorts of other sorts of places. So I think that in the conversations I hear in the climate policy arena, this is not the biggest ticket item, so it may not be the biggest area of focus. At the same time, we all know that a lot of energy is used in remediation practices, and that I think across the economy and across society, people are going to have to find a way to make reductions. But I do think that we need to be extremely cautious about the idea of directly balancing carbon emissions, which have a global impact, against local environmental impacts like local air health concerns or local soil and groundwater contamination or local water quality issues. And although I'm not an expert in life cycle analysis and other things, I think in the practice there's a lot of caution about how to do that. And I think that that we need to be very deliberative in how we think about what's an appropriate way to balance different pollutants, an appropriate way to balance different risks. And so I think that we have a lot of improvements we can make to our footprint, but I think that the carbon footprint of the country is much bigger than what we can reduce within just remediation. So I think that that is one of the major areas that we need to all think about and figure out how to do appropriately.
One final question from online. How can watershed associations get involved with green remediation? And this is from Bill Brainerd with CRC Watersheds Association in Media, Pennsylvania.
I think that that is a really, really great question. And actually, I don't have the website with me. There's a we did a little bit of work with, what can I think of their name? River Rally and the River. We've done some work explicitly on pilots with cleanup programs and watersheds, watershed protection. And we also have published a document that specifically talks about how you can do watershed protection and cleanup better by combining the authorities of the different programs. So I think both in terms of implementing regulatory programs, there is a great deal of things that we could do. But I think also at the community level, I think that the handling of these complex cleanup issues and even less complex cleanups issues and all the local watershed planning issues that are being tied into local development issues, there's a complete connection. And there has been some work through pilots and some guidance, but some documents that talk about that in more depth, and I'd be happy to share some of that information with you specifically if you want it.
Thanks, Kathy. An easy question. Your email address? Someone had the question online, and I thought
I think it's on the site, but it's just alan.catherine@epa.gov.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's move on to our second speaker, and that is, she is Deb Goldblum, who has worked in EPA's Mid-Atlantic office in Region 3. She's in the RCRA Corrective Action Program. She's been there for 16 years, and she is currently Region 3's RCRA Revitalization Coordinator and is a key contributor to a national effort to integrate green remediation into the cleanup programs. She has worked on several projects in collaboration with EPA headquarters, including the RCRA Groundwater Handbook, and co-leading the development of measures to assess the status of land use at cleanup sites. Prior to joining EPA, Ms. Goldblum taught geology at Temple University and LaSalle University. She received her BS in geology from Haverford College and an MS in geology from Temple. Welcome, Deb.
Thanks, Mike, for the introduction, and thanks, Kathy, for doing that great overview. And I'm going to step down from her 30,000-foot view to something down more specific to actual a site case example, and the example is how we try to incorporate some sort of sustainability assessment into the remedy decision process at a RCRA corrective action site. And so you can go from slide onto slide 36 now, and just to give you an idea of green cleanup basics, in the broadest terms, what we want to do is maximize the net environmental benefit of a cleanup and minimize those inadvertent impacts that may occur. We can do this by using our resources wisely, by considering the big environmental picture, and by integrating cleanup with reuse. Next slide. So we're on slide 37. And for those who are unfamiliar with the RCRA remedy selection criteria process, there are different evaluation criteria depending on which program you have. Superfund has some criteria, and the voluntary cleanup programs have criteria. And this is the RCRA remedy selection criteria. And RCRA historically has dealt with the industrial properties and cleaning up their historical waste operations, historical releases at their site. So under the RCRA remedy selection criteria, we have three threshold criteria. You're going to protect human health and the environment, and you're going to control the sources of your contamination, and you're going to meet your cleanup objectives. And that means you're going to reach certain levels at certain places. Okay, so your example is you're going to clean up a soil to a certain level at this point of compliance. And then we have seven balancing factors, long-term reliability, short-term protectiveness, effectiveness, cost, etc. And the idea with this pilot was if you had multiple remedies on the table and so it passed the threshold criteria, we looked at those seven balancing criteria factors. Could we have another balancing factor called sustainability to help us evaluate the situation? And so this is specifically for a RCRA site, but I have to say, in general, the evaluation criteria across at least Superfund and RCRA are not significantly different. Slide 38. So this pilot was done with the DuPont, and it was in a particular DuPont facility. And the idea was, when we said, okay, could we do this sustainability framework, that was a good idea, but what does that mean? And so first thing we had to do is say, what are the factors that we're going to deal with? How are we going to measure this? And what is going to be our process for implementing this? Slide 39. So we started with, we had a lot of ideas on a whiteboard. We brainstormed teams, a team of DuPont individuals, a team of Region 3 RCRA folks that are in the cleanup program here. And we said, well, sustainability could be all these things, but it seems awfully unwieldy to manage. So we tried to refine it to something that we could get our arms around. So let's go to slide 40, please. And this is what it looked like. We said we're going to look at greenhouse gases and energy, and sort of as our measure of greenhouse gases, we were just going to use CO2 in this case. We're going to look at the energy. And then we're also going to look at the resources consumed and recycled as part of this cleanup. So we're going to look at the soil and solid material that's used or reused. We're going to look at the water use and reuse, and we're going to look at the land use and reuse. So we'll go on to slide 41. The site is DuPont-Martinsville site. It's located in the very southern part of Virginia. This site is about 550 acres. It operated from 1941 to 1998. It's no longer operating. And, in fact, a lot of these buildings have been razed on site. There's only like one small manufacturing operation going on site. The golf course that you can see north of the buildings, that's been there for a long time and, in fact, covers some solid waste management units. And topographically, it is wrapped around by the Smith River, wraps around it, and, in fact, wraps around to the, I'd say, the upper north back side of the site. And there's a lot of relief here. It's not necessarily apparent on the side. It's fairly, you know, close to the river down the southern portion, and as you go up towards an area where it says Unit H, you're up about 200 feet above the river at that point. And so at the end of the investigation, we saw that there were three areas. We investigated numerous areas on the site where there could be potential releases, and we saw three areas warranted a further study for a cleanup, and those areas were the fryer training area, the DuPont Precision Concepts building area where there's a source underneath the building, and the Unit H1 area. And I'm going to just focus on just that Unit H1 area as a case example for this talk. Next slide. And what I want to do is walk you through how we did the sustainability assessment, okay? And so the first thing I want to do is tell you, here's the framework we set up, okay? So we have greenhouse gases and energy. And in particular, on this talk, I'm going to walk you through how we did the CO2 estimate of emissions for the cleanup. What was unique about this credit and debit approach, first of all, we used, as Kathy mentioned, life cycle analysis techniques to assess the environmental outcome of the cleanup. So, for example, if you go to the energy row and look at the debit side, we're not looking just at the energy used for the remediation. You'll see the energy used for the manufacturing of consumables to do the remediation, and then also used for the management of residuals later on. So this is what we mean by a life cycle analysis technique. What's also really different about this from the typical remedy evaluation that I've done is generally our number. What we do is we have qualitative results. We say this remedy looks more protective than that remedy. This one is sort of has more short-term risks than the other one, but it's not quantitative. At the end of this assessment, we had quantifiable results. What this credit and debit matrix does, it sort of puts some items in the positive, the credit box, and some in the minus box. So, for example, we look at this carbon dioxide equivalent row. You'll see that it's a plus when you sequester carbon dioxide on site, such as, for example, if you spread biosolids on site, that can actually sequester carbon. Or if you had trees on site, that would sequester carbon. And then we looked at a negative, the CO2 output from implemented from the remedy implementation, and that would be the fuel and the energy used for the cleanup, the manufacturing consumables, the management of residuals, and any loss of sequestration through vegetation removal. Now, there was we got to this point of the framework, and I say it's clearly a work in progress. Some real challenges that we came across were the water challenge. If you look at that row, you'll see a plus for water that's reused and recycled, and a minus for public or surface water use, and then you'll see one groundwater captured for remediation where a resource is critical. We didn't want to presumptively rule out pump and treats, and sometimes that's really a necessary remedy. And as Kathy said, there's a challenge in balancing these issues, but in this case, this was our way of somehow finding a middle ground for that area of using groundwater and when you can use it. It's not perfect. Another real challenge was land use. While I feel really comfortable saying the credit for no limitations to anticipated use and wetlands created or upgraded and conservation easements, that's great. The challenge is with the debit. If it has permanent limited use, is that really a minus? Because I'd say there's certain sites that are a landfill, they have permanent limited use. Maybe the best use for that is a golf range, or maybe it's a parking lot, but it's not sure that that's a bad thing. And so, again, that's another challenge with this credit-debit matrix approach that we actually never found the perfect solution. Now, we had six all-day meetings with DuPont, and the two teams came together to get it refined to this. It probably needs at least 6 or 12 more meetings and several more pilots to make it more applicable across cleanup sites. So this is our start. Next slide. So we're in slide 43, and it says conceptual framework for sustainability analysis. And what I want to walk you through is how we did the carbon calculation for the Unit H1, this one area. And like any project, at the end of the investigation, we say, okay, we had this area of contamination, and that's project data. We know how big it is, how deep it is, what the contaminants are, their mobility. And then we come up with options, remedial options, so we have A, B, C, D, et cetera. What's unique is this calculation module where we're going to consider the transportation, the treatment, and the water use. And at the end of the day, we're going to come up with some numbers, and it's going to be an output into step 4, your sustainability factors, which is going to go back in the matrix. So let's go to slide 44. And this slide shows actually a picture of Unit H1. And Unit H1 was a former finishing oil disposal pond, and there were fairly innocuous oils that went into that pond, but unfortunately some other things went in that pond that were not so innocuous. And so as a result, we have an area that is contaminated groundwater with chlorinated VOCs in the soil and in the groundwater. Then it was filled in with some coal ash and had some PCBs and some arsenic in it. Now, this pond is not that big. You can see there's a picture there showing the 1970s and 2004 later when it was filled in. It was only about 100 feet in diameter. The impacts were about 4.5 feet in thickness to serious source area. As I said, because the release goes up in that area, it's up on a hill, the groundwater is about 90 feet below ground surface, and DuPont estimated that the impacted soil volume is probably about 63,000 cubic feet. So we'll go on to slide 45. And so the first thing we do is say, what's our objective? And our objective for this unit was to clean up to the drinking water standards for this area using a combination of source control or treatment, and then to use monitored natural attenuation to deal with the more dilute portions of the pollutants. And so to reach that goal, we had many options that we discussed in a room and threw up on a whiteboard, but then we had to see which ones passed the record remedy three threshold criteria. And when we went through that process, we were left with these 5. So we could excavate the material and send it to a landfill and use monitored natural attenuation. We could excavate it and use ex-situ thermal treatment and use MNA. You could cap it in place. You could use soil vapor extraction in place. Or you could use zero-valent iron in-situ treatment, which is when you mix in soil mixing of iron and bentonite to destroy the chlorinates and bind up the other contaminants. Next slide, please. So we're on to slide 46. And this is step 3 of the process. And this is different from most remedy selection evaluation. What we had to do here, we need to look at what are all the materials you need for this remedy, for the ZVI. So it's just one example. Where are we going to transport those materials from and get them to the site? What's the distance? How much fuel are we going to need to transport those materials to the site? What is the fuel for the equipment at the site? How many people are we going to need to implement this remedy? How many days are they going to work? Where are they going to come from? What's their fuel transportation use to the site? So as I said, there are a lot of assumptions with this. And if anyone knows who's implemented cleanup, Murphy's Law is always out there, about to get you. So there are a lot of assumptions, but with, to give us a general idea, slide 47. So we identify all the components that go in the remedy, and we got to quantify them. And we're going to keep the fuel separate. The fuel that's gasoline needs to be separated from the fuel that is diesel because they have a different amount of CO2 output from them when you do life cycle analysis. So, as I said, we're going to identify all the fuel from the remedy, the mobilization, the demob, the mixing, the regrading, the subbase, et cetera. And we're going to calculate how many gallons of gasoline we're going to use to do all that. And then we're also going to calculate how many gallons of diesel we're going to need to implement this remedy. And then on top of that, we're going to determine the quantity of the consumables we'll need to implement this remedy. So we need the zero-valent iron, we need the bentonite, we need the kiln dust, and what are their volumes. All that is big spreadsheets, and it's all simplified to a PowerPoint. So now I'll go to slide 48, and although I'm a geologist, what I learned as part of this process is that there are sources on the web, such as NREL, which is the National Renewable Energy Lab, which provides information on the CO2 output from different materials used. So if you look at circled up there, the diesel from the estimate of impound CO2 from diesel, and you'll see that 1,000 gallons of diesel has an estimated CO2 output of 25,801 pounds. In contrast, if you look at gasoline, 1,000 gallons of gasoline has an estimated CO2 output of 20,179 pounds. So that's why I said you have to keep gasoline and diesel separate, and then you have to get all your consumables. And below are some example websites and numbers that are available. Also be careful that units change in Europe and the U.S., so everything has to be converted to whatever unit you want to use, but just be careful. And the other thing to be careful about is that these numbers can vary as much as 20% or more depending on which source you use, okay? And there were times where we could find no readily available source, and then we had to go to a life cycle analysis person to help us out to sort of find a surrogate for that material. So some things were easy. There were a few challenges. Slide 49. And so once you have determined how much fuel you have in gallons, and we're going to keep diesel and gasoline separate, and you're going to multiply them by your conversion factors, and you take your consumables, and you're going to multiply those by your conversion factors, you're going to get a number, okay? And that number estimates the amount of CO2 emissions using life cycle techniques for that particular remedy option. So, for example, the ZVI treatment, the estimate was it would emit approximately 170 pounds CO2, ton equivalent to implement that remedy. And then we also threw in an estimate for the natural attenuation component, and we estimate we were going to do quarterly sampling for the first 2 years, and then semi-annual sampling out to 5 years, and then annual out a couple years, and then it went biannual out to 30 years. And that added another 5 CO2 ton equivalent into the calculation. Slide 50. So now we take those numbers and we go back to the original matrix and we put them back in. So we'll see for the CO2, there was no credit. We had zero, and we had for a debit 175 carbon dioxide ton equivalent for implementing the VVI remedy and all the consumables associated with it. And we estimated the energy use was 791,000 kilowatts of energy for implementing this technology at this site. You'll see soil was pretty small. There were 200 tons of soil needed to cap the area. Land use was pretty insignificant, and water use was minimal. The reason I highlight CO2 in this case is because that was seemed the most interesting in this case. It's probably because of the small size of the unit. I saw BP do an example where they used a similar framework, and actually for them the land use played out to be a very important part. So one should not just be focusing always on the CO2, but in this case, it happened to be the most interesting component. Let's go on to slide 51. So when I started out, I said we looked at 5 remedies that passed the threshold criteria, and these are the results we got for estimates of CO2 output for implementing these remedies. The first thing you should notice is there are way too many significant figures in this picture, okay, because there were so many assumptions that went into it, assumptions with the transportation, assumption of where they get material, assumption with the CO2 conversion values. Let's look at it as a gross estimate, and we'll say that we can think about orders of magnitude. The X52 thermal treatment, yes, that's the highest. That's big, okay, bigger than the other ones. The soil vapor extraction, the off-site excavation off-site disposal, and the ZVI, they're all in the same realm, okay, of what they would result in CO2 equivalents. And the capping was the least. Now, it doesn't mean that we picked capping. In fact, at this site, DuPont and EPA, we selected zero-valent iron for this site as the choice remedy, as a remedy that was being that is being implemented now at that site. But the idea was this is just another factor to consider amongst many factors, and it was not the sole factor. Slide 52. So from the team that worked on this, there was a lot of feedback. I mean, in general, everyone thought that this approach led to more innovation. Once you start doing the calculation, you think about things that you hadn't considered before, and that in itself will help people optimize how they implement a remedy. In this case, it was a very collaborative process. It's clearly a more robust evaluation. I think typically the only numbers I usually see on a remedy selection evaluation of the cost, and after that, it's all much more qualitative. There are some that are concerned, and rightfully so, that this could be dangerous. There's too much opportunity for monkey business because you can, as I said, there's a lot of assumption, and you can fudge numbers with every which way depending on where you want your preference to go. There's a concern that every site could go to a natural attenuation because if you just focus on energy alone and not those other attributes that are equally important, such as cleaning up the site, then, yes, you will move everybody towards a remedy such as natural attenuation being the only thing. The thing that actually, the item that concerns me most was actually to slow down the cleanup time because, as Kathy said, these numbers are important, but they're not the biggest, you know, relative to other things people are doing to affect climate change. It's a small piece of the puzzle. So to actually just slow down our cleanup to do these more extensive evaluations and make it a mandatory approach, it's my personal feeling, and this is not an agency thought, that this may not be a good thing to do everywhere. We have numerous sites to clean up and limited resources, so that is a concern. But I do have some potential solutions, and the agency is working on some of these, okay? So slide 53. One idea is if there are individuals out there in consultants, et cetera, that, and EPA, they're working ways to streamline the carbon analysis. For example, perhaps we don't use that many remedies really across the board, so could we just look at the fuel use, the energy use, and perhaps the key consumables? I had looked at the data we had for the ZVI technology, see if we could just use the fuel use and energy use. The problem with that is that actually the consumables really played a large part if you're just looking at the carbon footprint in the actual output at the end. So if you want to, using life cycle analysis there really made a difference. There's a rules of thumb approach being considered. I mean, EPA is currently in the process of sort of developing, let's say, cheat sheets for different technologies to give ideas of best management practices to help green up our remedies. So that is actually already ongoing and being worked on. And then another project that is in its early phases is something called a green cleanup standard and Region 3 and actually all of the aqua cleanup programs and many regions now are working as a team to see if we had developed a green cleanup standard that all cleanup programs and states can look to as a way to define what we call a green cleanup. The idea is that it would be there universally applied across cleanup programs. And I could talk about that, but I think we'll need another webinar to talk about that. Next slide, 54, please. So if we go back to the credit debit matrix, and I said in this we did a quantitative evaluation, and we looked at certain things, and we said they're a plus and other things are a minus. And what I tried to do then is take from this plot, I knew that a lot of people can't do this kind of assessment every site, and I tried to take these results or this matrix and make it into a value statement or objective. So next slide. So what we're really trying to do, if you look at greenhouse gases and energy, that plus and minus for the CO2, we're trying to minimize the ancillary impacts such as CO2 emissions to the air and other emissions. We're trying to minimize the total energy use and promote use of renewable energies as part of green cleanups. And with regard to resource conservation, we're trying to preserve and restore natural resources, maximize the recycling material, and maximize the reuse options for land. So these are our goals as a result from this framework, I would say. Next slide. And so the challenge now looking forward is if, for example, the RCRA a selection criteria, has these balancing factors, and the idea is how do you bring the balancing factors we have and integrate them with these kind of green cleanup goals. The current framework we have does not make an intuitive connection between those circles, okay? And that's why one of the ideas we're considering is do you build a green cleanup standard sort of outside the actual remedy decision process to help facilitate and move forward green cleanups. For example, in 2002, there were 38 LEED certified cleanups. Okay. Now, in 2007, there were over 800 plus LEED certified cleanups. So the idea is, if you put a framework out there and a thought process, and actually can provide incentives to get people to move in a new way, perhaps we can also have more green up cleanups across the cleanup program. Next slide. That's just my contact information. If anybody has questions, I'm available now or later. Thank you.
Thanks, Deb. We do have time for a few questions, and you can either submit them via the web page, which is through the question mark at the top of the page, or on the phone. Don't have any online right now. Let's start with the phone. Anybody have any questions for Deb?
Yes, this is Ellen Moyer of CH2M Hill, and I'm interested in the LEED certified cleanups. By this, do you mean sites that get the brownfield redevelopment point? I wasn't aware of that.
I heard that LEED certified, there were that many LEED certified cleanups, and unless my numbers are incorrect, but the LEED, let's just say independent of LEED certified, just the buildings, has enhanced the number of sustainable building practices across the program. The idea is if we could develop a cleanup approach, maybe it would have that same impact.
Okay, I wasn't aware that there were such a thing as LEED certified cleanups. I thought there were not. LEED certified buildings.
LEED certified buildings. If I said cleanups, I was completely misspoken then. Yes, I meant green buildings, and my apologies.
Okay, no problem. I thought it was a new exciting area that had opened up.
Yeah, we're trying to get there, but we're not there yet.
Yeah, okay, thanks.
Here's one from the Internet. How do you consider the relative importance of each row in your credit and debit matrix for decision-making? This is from Joe Chai at Dow Chemical in Midland, Michigan.
I don't think there's a weighting factor. I think you have to just look at it all holistically. It's not just the sustainability framework, but all the other factors, long-term protectiveness, short-term effectiveness, community acceptance. There is no weight of one over the other. I think that's clearly a professional judgment decision.
Thanks, Deb. Any more questions from the phone?
Yeah, Dorothy Allen from Massachusetts again. I have a question in regards to lowering emissions, and I guess this goes to policy. There's Kyoto that we haven't joined, but maybe we'll be joining soon. And I know the states have developed climate change reduction goals, and cities and towns are putting together climate change action plans that choose to reduce goals, that have reduction goals in them, and they choose to or try to reduce their emissions by a certain amount by a certain year. And I'm wondering if anybody at EPA is thinking that perhaps all our activity, regulatory activity, should also have climate change emission reduction goals to reduce emissions by a certain amount by certain dates.
I would say clearly that's a policy decision, and I am not involved with that policy decision. I think Kathy's here. She may be better prepared to answer that.
Well, this is Kathy. There have not been any policy decisions like that right now. There's not a policy decision right now that all federal regulatory programs should have a reduction goal. But I do think that, if different actions do get reduction goals, I think it's going to be really, people are going to evaluate how much out of the total carbon is this activity responsible for, and how much does it cost to reduce a ton of carbon from that activity, and how long does that take. So I think those kinds of policy questions are still very much open in general for national climate change policy, and there is nothing like that right now.
Thanks. Here's one from the Internet. This is a question from Ann Lewis Russ from AECOM Environment in Brandenburg, Kentucky. I missed the reason that fuel is listed twice, and this is in the page 48 spreadsheet.
I can assume what you're saying is fuel is 48 spreadsheet. I'll go to 48. I can find it. But the idea is that you need to consider diesel fuel separate from gasoline because they have different carbon footprints, basically.
Yeah, I think if you look at the top two and then the next three after that, maybe that's what...
Well, then they're in kilograms. There's different units. The one with the top two is just diesel, gasoline, 1,000 gallons. The other was 1 kilogram, so it's a different unit. And that's the only thing that's showing there.
Okay. Any other questions from the phone?
Can we go again?
Certainly.
Okay, I've got another question. As a matter of fact, we're on that slide. We're on 48. You know, you use EcoInvent, and I actually went on that website. It costs about $10,000 to become a member. Is there a government source or kind of a more of an open, verifiable source for this kind of information other than going to a private website?
NREL, the National Renewable Energy Lab, is the best source I saw out there, but I'm certainly not an expert in this.
But the EcoInvent is what's listed for most of your materials. So I guess my question is there somebody working in the government to develop these numbers?
Since I'm a regional person and an implementer, we just did this as a case study with DuPont. Those are the sources they used, and we verified those sources, but we didn't go out there and check for other sources. And I can't tell you if agency-wide, if there are other individuals looking into or other pieces, people looking into different sources for this information.
Someone here in Region 9 may be able to help.
Yeah, this is Karen Sherman. We had that same question here in Region 9, and we're starting to work with ORD. They actually have a couple of folks who are working on life cycle analysis and may be able to help us with those numbers. One name is Jane Baer, B-A-R-E, and we've been starting to work with her. But we've had the same problem here in Region 9, trying to get good information. Since our budget is limited, we can't always pay that $10,000. So we're trying to find information within EPA at the same time.
I know that you've got the waste reduction model that has developed numbers for a lot of the waste constituents. I'm wondering if that can be expanded. And this is from Oswer, I believe.
I think you're talking about the waste reduction model, which is called the WARM model.
That's
and
right.
And they do have the data in there so that you can look at different materials and whether you landfill them or recycle them or source reduce them. And then you can come up with a energy and carbon estimate based on the life cycle analysis of that document, right?
Well, when I looked at that website, they actually gave CO2 equivalent emissions for various waste constituents.
That's right.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so that's the WARM model, and Augur does manage that model, and it's looking at materials management options for a select list of materials. I know that there are different life cycle analysis databases out there, and I also can't answer where the agency is at on that, but I know that ORD and others have life cycle analysis groups that are looking at those things. So maybe that's something you could follow up with an email and we could try to connect you.
Okay, thank you. Here's more of a comment than a question, I believe, from Bill Sandine from the Environmental Liability Management in Princeton, New Jersey. Associated with site SI and remediations are occupational risks, some of which, such as truck use, also pose an actual risk to the public. Therefore, occupation risks must be part of the sustainability analysis, since the real risk of the SI/remediation may exceed the potential risk of the site. That's more of a comment, but any comments on the comment? Two types of risk, I guess, is the question, is the comment. I'll take that as a no.
Mike, I will address it some. I mean, some of it has to do with, because I've heard this argument before, and this is Deb, okay? And Kathy at one point showed the three stools, and it showed economic, social, and environment, and that being sustainability. And the sustainability being the intersection of those three. I would say that our idea, or why we call it green remediation, is actually because this balancing, that perfect balance, is not always so easy to do, and our mission comes from the environment. To the extent we can balance all three parts of the stool, that's a good thing. But the other thing, I think there's a confusion sometimes between involuntary risk and voluntary risk that get mushed together here, and so the idea is if people have better health and safety plans, it doesn't mean people shouldn't clean up because there's a risk associated with the actual cleanup.
Okay, great. Thank you. Back to slide 48 again. How were CO2 equivalents calculated on slide 48? This is a question from Mohit Bhargava at Patel in Columbus, Ohio.
Mike, I'm sorry, you're cutting out. What was that? How was what calculated?
How were CO2 equivalents calculated on slide 48? I think they were referenced from NREL, correct?
They're referenced from NREL, most of the sources, and so that you got it, Mike. They're referenced from NREL, those numbers. You'd have to go to the NREL database, you know, to their website to figure out how they determine those CO2 equivalents.
Any other questions from the phone? Okay, here's one from the Internet. It says, not a question, but help with an answer regarding EcoInvent and LTI databases. There are many CO2 equivalency/emissions data available on the Internet free of charge through the Greenhouse Gas Protocol and World Resources Institute. It's a good place to start for those who don't have access to LTI databases. And that's from Mail Smith at Northgate Environmental in Oakland, California. Questions from the phone. Okay, well, thanks, everybody, for attending today. This is the second in our series of three green remediation seminars will be held on December 16th and the third on January 13th next year. Each will discuss green remediation case studies and tools. Please go to the cluin.org website to sign up. And if this first seminar was any indication, you should do it soon because they filled up pretty fast. If you know people who couldn't get on, please remind them that all of these seminars are archived on cluin.org. And thank you again, and for those of us in the U.S., happy Thanksgiving. Take care.